Problemet er at mange land har stater som har...
Hei! My name is Julia Redje. With me today I have Thea.
Hi!
Okay, let's go.
Argentina's financial crisis has been festering for 15 years.
Stater tøffere og tøffere og tøffere over disse landene.
And welcome to Gjeldsbrevet. My name is Julia Redje, and I'm the director of Debt Justice Norway.
Hi. Yes, I'm Thea Grastveit, policy advisor with Debt Justice Norway.
So nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Yes.
I hardly ever see you.
Never.
Only every day.
Yes. And today we are doing this in English as well, so
yes.
This will be exciting. Because this is an important issue, and it has international value and relevance as well. So
yeah.
We thought this could be a good idea.
Yes.
Because you have just released or finished,
just finalized
mm-hmm. This report named Developing Best Practice Guidelines for Responsible Private Investment in Sovereign Debt Instruments.
Yes. That's true.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. We just finalized it. It hasn't been released yet, but it will be after Christmas when this podcast is airing. and it was authored by Dilmi Vijesekara and Amalie Ramstein Ness, and I was editing the report. And it's about how private investors can develop their due diligence processes to secure more responsibility in lending to sovereigns, in investing in sovereign debt instruments, basically. Yes.
So what is that? What is responsible private investments, basically?
Yeah. So states can borrow money for development purposes or any other purpose. And one of the ways they borrow money is in the private market. And this is through a financial instrument called sovereign bonds or government bonds. So what happens is that a state can make a contract saying they want to borrow $100 million, for instance, and say that they promise to pay 6% interest. And then they sell it on the private market. The international bond market. And then if investors want to invest in this government bond, they can do that. And then if you have several investors, you end up with the amount of money you wanted to have. And then what you do is you only pay 6% interest each year. And let's say that this government bond is for 10 years. And then after 10 years, while you have paid 6% interest per year, you sort of try to roll over the whole principal, the amount of money you borrowed in the first place. So, for example, if you're a private person borrowing money for buying an apartment, like each year you have to pay interest,
yes.
But you also have to down pay on your loan. And then after 20, 30 years of paying it down, you end up with zero loan and you own your apartment. But when it comes to states, when they borrow money on the private markets, they don't pay down payments. They don't have down payments on the loan. They only pay interest. So after 10 years, you still have the same amount of money you borrowed in the first place that you need to borrow again because you're going to repay your old lenders. So
this is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about my own like loan for studying. You should have proposed the whole thing for 10 years.
Yeah. So postponing it means that you're sort of pushing your risk into the future. And what you're betting on then is if 10 or 5 or 3 years have passed, that the economic activity globally has gone up, that your national gross domestic product has increased. And you're sort of betting on economic activity going in a positive direction, which then means you will be able to borrow $100 million again in the market and repay your old debts.
Yeah.
The problem here is that what often happens is that when you need to refinance your old government bond, financial external structures might have changed, or your national economic situation has changed. So if your economic situation is worse than it was 10 years ago, you might have to borrow at a higher interest. Because the higher risk, the higher interest. Because a private investor will take a higher pay for taking higher interest, higher risk. So then when you're going to borrow this amount to repay your old debts, you might have to borrow it to for 8% interest, for example. So the conundrum here is that because your economic situation has worsened, you have to pay more than you did before. And that's the problem, because then you have to borrow the same amount of money again to repay your old debts. But because you have less money, you also have to pay more for it.
Yeah.
So this is the way that states are often traditionally entering sort of a unsustainable sovereign debt cycle. That they borrow money and then something changes that deteriorates their economic situation. And then when they have to refinance, it's increasingly more expensive to borrow. And also in the same time, economic activity might have slowed down. So you have less income than you used to have. And then you end up having to pay more and more of your national income on servicing your debts. And then you have to cut back on all the other things. So then you have to use less money on education, health, social security, other types of investments. So this is sort of how a state enters a sovereign debt crisis. And when it comes to government bonds specifically, that's how private investments in government debt contribute to either positive economic development in a country, or it also might contribute to deteriorating economic situations. So it matters how private investors invest in government bonds. That matters. If they do it in a responsible way, then the money can go to financing financially sound, good projects in a country who has like a fiscal space and economic situation to handle external shocks like financial crisis, natural disasters, war for that matter, and still be able to both repay their debts and finance their welfare obligations and other investment needs. But if you borrow money, lend money to a country in an irresponsible way, or in a way where you don't systematically assess the sovereign's ability to repay in a broader sense, then you might contribute to a debt crisis. And the reason for this is that the way investors normally assess a nation or a state's financial situation is that they assess the risk of the state defaulting. And this is what rating agencies do, where you get sort of different grades. Like if you're AAA, you're a best grade.
Yeah.
You know, and then lower. And what these ratings do is that they classify the risk of a sovereign defaulting on their debts, which is sort of the reason you're assessing that as an investor is that you're assessing the risk of me not getting my money back. You know, that's what you assess.
Your own economic interests.
Yeah, yeah. But a state's capacity to repay their debts is actually much broader than that. Because a sovereign can experience difficulties in financing their debt obligations much earlier. The actual debt problem starts when the country have to start cutting back on investments in health, education, social security, and new investments like energy, like climate financing, investing in expensive new energy projects, or it could be like airports and trains and roads, whatever. So when the country starts having to cut back, you're starting to enter sort of this debt cycle. And what this report is proposing is that private investors also have to start assessing this risk in a much broader sense. They can't just like look at the end of a long process, meaning the point where the state is in high risk of defaulting of stopping to repay their debts. Mm. They have to assess a much broader risk category. They and just to exemplify how this works or how this could work, Norway has a sovereign wealth fund, the world's largest sovereign wealth fund, owning roughly 1% or more of stocks globally. And the sovereign wealth fund has a system for assessing risk when they are investing in sovereign in government bonds that is that has this sort of like broad comprehensive definition. So they're not just looking at the rating and the risk of default, they're looking at a broad set of categories. So they're looking at default risk, but they're also looking at other indicators that can tell you something about the fiscal space for mitigating external shocks. They're also looking at other sort of governmental social factors that can, in a broad sense, impact on a sovereign's ability to repay their debt. Mm. So they're looking at sort of social factors, labor rights, risk of corruption, a state's respect for civil and political rights. They can be looking at different environmental, climatic aspects. Mm. And together, all of these different indicators that make up like a comprehensive definition of debt sustainability, they're able to sort of capture much more of what it means to have the financial space to service their debts, where a state also has the financial space to invest in welfare.
Yeah. And bringing the social aspect and not only looking at the numbers, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So this report is sort of just arguing that if private investors are to avoid contributing to a sovereign debt crisis, they need to apply this broader definition of debt sustainability. And in doing so, that would make them a more responsible private investor in sovereign debt instruments, and less likely to contribute to sovereign debt crisis, and more likely to contribute to positive economic and social development.
Great. But what can they do? What does the report say that actually the private actors can do to be more responsible?
Yeah. Okay, so this report assesses different frameworks that is already out there, from everything from the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, to the UNPRI, and different private investors, for example, the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund. And it sort of systematically assess the overlaps between these different types of frameworks that have the common aim of securing a more responsible investment in government debt. And then sort of just synthesizes the common denominator and then makes this into a recommendation that is specifically tailored to private investors. Like, these are the principles you should take into consideration when investing in sovereign debt. And our hope is that if many investors broaden out their due diligence processes and operationalize a much broader definition of responsible investments in sovereign debt, that in sum, when many hundreds, thousands of different investors do this, that in some this strengthened responsibility can then sort of in some contribute to avoiding this buildup of a, like a bubble. That's what's happening now, is that because you don't have enough regulations internationally to regulate the flow of private finance into sovereign debt. Because of this lack of regulation, it has a tendency to blow up like a bubble, and then it bursts and it becomes like systemic sovereign debt crisis, like the one we had in the 80s and the 90s. So if many investors in some do this voluntarily with their own systems, it can sort of like make the accumulation of sovereign debt slower and more sustainable and avoid buildup of bubbles. So that's sort of the systemic argument
for you need this as a standard for all of them in order to not create a new systemic financial bubble and then a crisis.
Yeah.
But do you think it's possible to get these private actors on board? And I know you have also been in contact with some, particularly Norwegian actors, for this report in the work. What is their comments and what do they think?
Yeah, I mean, like specifically in Norway, there's sort of like a tradition for what you call ESG, like an environmental social governance factor, investments. There's a tradition for sort of having the socially responsible, ethical approach to investments. So in that sense, like here in Norway, working on this topic is very, it feels useful because you see these different actors actually developing pretty broad and sound systems, and also ensuring implementation that is meaningful. And especially, for example, with the Sovereign Wealth Fund, this works very well. At this point, for example, the Sovereign Wealth Fund is not invested in any of these countries that are likely to experience a sovereign debt crisis in the coming years, because of this system for ensuring responsible investments. But the risk, the other side of the coin, is of course that the risk is that this just becomes like a greenwashing. Because it's a volunteer system. And there is no like external body monitoring. There's a very real risk of it becoming just like a greenwash, where you can use it for promotional purposes and give the impression of being socially aware and responsible when in fact you're not. So of course, like the devil's in the detail in the implementation of these types of investments.
Do you have any thoughts on how you can reduce that risk of greenwashing, or how this can actually be a good system and good guidelines to actually create a change in their investments and not only be a nice symbol of continue, do what you do and call it better, sort of?
Yeah, I mean, there are some elements that are important, and I can just illustrate it, for example, with the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund again, but this is the same for several other Norwegian investors like Storebrand or KLP or others, is that the main thing is actually transparency, because transparency, being transparent about your investment process, is what makes you accountable, basically. So you have to be transparent on what are the principles? How do we measure these principles? Which indicators do we use? What kind of data sets do we use to assess these indicators? And then be open about which issuers of government bonds are checking these boxes and which aren't. And then also be transparent about which investments you're actually making. Because if you're sort of open about your goal and then open about all the steps you're taking on the road to that goal, then the public, general public, can hold you accountable and say, you're stating this goal, but we don't see you substantiating how these steps are going to take you to this goal. Or you're exposing yourself to input on how to improve implementation and operationalization. So that's one important way to do this.
Making our job easier.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah. So inviting civil society and other actors to input on and keeping you accountable. But another way of doing it is that in the Nordic countries, you have something called the Nordic Eco Label, which is sort of a certification that's established by the Nordic Council and, of States. And this eco label certifies all kinds of different stuff. It started out as being like certifying, you know, soaps and papers and whatever, saying it's environmentally sound. But it's become a much broader definition. And one of the things that the Nordic eco label is certifying is funds, like investment funds. So if you want to invest in a global index fund, for instance, that invests in companies, you can choose to have an certified fund. And when the Nordic Eco Label certifies a fund, it certifies that they have a quite rigorous process for assessing risk, and that the actual investments follow those risk assessments. So that's like an external body, which is a non-profit governmental body that certifies, and that it's kind of difficult to get the Nordic Eco Label certification, but that means that you're avoiding greenwashing, basically. If you choose an Eco Label certified fund, you can be sure it's not a greenwash, you know. So, and this can apply to other types of investors. Even though the Eco Label is a Nordic certification, investors from all over the world can apply for a certification from the Eco Label. But of course, there could be other certifications globally. I think there's like a market for those types of certifications, specifically for government bonds.
Yeah, so it can have, if we start with the Nordic one, it might can have a lot of repercussions and set a standard for broader funds and labels as well.
Yeah, so I mean, this could be a positive contribution, and if a lot of different investors did it, it could have in some systemic impact. But like first step, it's kind of like small because it's volunteer, and it's very much based on like an opt-in. If customers demand these types of certified funds, they can purchase it. But it's not necessarily going to be the standards of all the investments or every investor doing this. So, I mean, it's like it could be useful and it could be important. And in some, it could also have a systemic implication. But it's just like one aspect. And there are several others that are even more important ones, which is like judicial changes in big jurisdictions like New York, like the UK, where you have judicial changes increasing responsibility in bond investments in a systemic way that has impact way beyond this topic.
Yeah.
And also international treaties, stuff like that, if they are actually implemented, can also have much broader implications. But at the moment, things are going too slow with judicial changes and with international treaties. And this is one important area where you can have some steps forward and having some also innovation that can feed back into other processes and strengthening possible future changes that are more systemic. So it's useful, but it's only a supplement to other more structural changes.
It's not the revolution that we need on the field, but it's absolutely one of many stepping stones and elements that will contribute to a better pathway for it.
And also, even though it doesn't really have a huge structural implication, like a judicial change or multilateral treaty or something like that. What's an additional positive effect is that if you have many private investors voluntarily strengthening their own systems for environmental social governance factors, then in some it can also have a positive effect in the sense that at the moment, some of the actors who are sort of blocking or impeding other processes, who are weakening multilateral processes, for example, is private sector lobbying.
Mm.
Private sector organizations who do not want changes, they actively discourage governments from strengthening global systems. And the more private investors who have voluntarily sort of implemented these goals in their own strategy, the less actors will sort of work actively against these important changes.
Mm.
So it's also about creating allies and creating positive synergies that in some can be an important contribution to more structural changes. And for example, in Norway, you see this, that it becomes more like a race to the top than a race to the bottom, because there are some front runners who take this seriously and do something beyond greenwashing. It's easier for other funds with less staff resources to sort of do the whole job themselves. It's easier for them to just follow what the sovereign wealth fund does, because they know they spent a lot of time and resources on substantiating their choices.
Mm.
It's easier for more funds to just do the same.
Mm.
And when you have this Nordic Eco Label, it can then also become like a standard that are common for many investors. So it's a sort of process of building positive alliances.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just to get like an easy tool for those who actually want to do good, because this is, of course, complicated, and it is a lot of different issues and potential conflicts in this. So if you have some big ones that you know are doing good, it's easier for the smaller ones. And if you get enough companies and funds and all of them doing sort of the same, it becomes maybe more embarrassed to not be in the best schicht and not doing the best. So it can also then be like a motivation for the those not ideal companies or funds as well.
Yeah.
Sort of pushing them.
Mm. Pushing the barrier. Mm. And so this is sort of, and then there's also another aspect to this report specifically, that it sort of also has an aim of feeding into more multilateral processes, because, for example, within the financing for development process in the UN, there's going to be a new financing for development conference in 2025. And one of the sort of aims that they have been restating almost every year in the outcome documents is that they're going to keep working on developing a global consensus on what it means to be a responsible lender and what it means to be a responsible borrower when it comes to like the sovereign sphere. And it seems like nobody really has the time and resources to sit down and sort of map out what this consensus could actually be. Like, what is the common denominator between the different frameworks out there? And that's what this report is doing. It's sort of like we're making a synthesis of existing frameworks, and that also becomes like an argument feeding into the FFD process, saying okay, here's a proposal. If you want to develop a global consensus, this is the common denominator of existing frameworks. And maybe that could be something to build a consensus from.
Mm.
So it has sort of like a dual aspect. It's both recommendations specifically for private investors, but it's also sort of doing the work of mapping and classifying different existing frameworks so that those recommendations can be more universal and more aimed at multilateral processes than only private investors specifically.
Yeah. So every private investor should absolutely read a report to see what they can do, but also like the broader civil society and state actors working towards the Financing for Development Conference in 2025 and the broader financial instruments issues at a global scale.
Yeah, yes. Those are the aims we're hoping to sort of influence. And hope those reading the report will find it useful. And also, yeah, we would love feedback. So yeah, if anyone reading it have some comments, you can just send it to us on mail.
Yeah, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
So what should people do who are listening or reading the report? Do you have any main point of action to
the audience? If you're a private investor reading it, then taking the recommendations into your own due diligence systems to improve them, improve implementation, improve operationalization. And then the Nordic Eco Label specifically, they have this certification of index funds where we have investments in companies. And in that framework, they have, I think it's like 3 criteria on government bonds. But what it means is that within and indexed investments in companies, you can have sort of like a percentage of the fund can be investments in government bonds. But we're encouraging them to take those criteria out and build a new certification specifically aimed at sovereign debt instruments, aimed at government bonds, to sort of, and then take our recommendations into it and making it especially a tailor-made certification for government bonds. And so those are like two. But when it comes to individuals, would be just getting engaged in the topic and asking your investor, your pension investor, your bank to take these recommendations into their own systems. And then in the multilateral space, if it's CEOs or if it's bureaucrats, politicians, to read it and look for different ways of implementing this in a multilateral space and developing this consensus on global consensus on responsible lending and borrowing to states, from states, to secure implementation of a broad global system for responsible lending and borrowing, because that's very much lacking at the moment.
Great. Let's hope everybody do this. But perfect. I haven't read the whole report myself yet, so I also look forward to doing that. But I've heard that we have got a lot of really good comments. People are really appreciating this report, and it is a new something that hasn't been done before, to have this actually mapping and making it easier. And it can be really, really useful for people. And that's what we have heard from international colleagues as well. So great work on this.
Thank you. And thank you to Amali and Dilmi, who did the job.
Yeah, great of all of them. Read the report. You can find it on our webpage, slettgjella.no, and also listen to more of our podcasts and of course on social media, Slettgjella.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Bye.